Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
One, with regard to what's going on in college campuses, the state of Florida is not New York. And so when you go out and try to commandeer a property, when you try to set up encampments, you are not going to be allowed to do that in this state. And people have found that out at University of South Florida, Florida State. So just understand that that's the way it's going to go. We do not allow the inmates to run the asylum in the state of Florida. And if you can't abide by the rules that we have in place for conduct, then we will show you the door and you will be expelled. It is that simple. That's what we're going to do.
The inmates do not run the asylum. Something a lot of people would agree with. But there are schools like Brown that are considering bowing to the inmates, divesting from Israel. Northwestern claiming they've reached a deal with student demonstrators. Over at Columbia, well, it seems to go just the opposite, where the students are trying to figure out if they're allowed to sue the university for failing to protect Jewish students and others. Tony Katz today. Good to be with you. William Jacobson joins us right now. I should say that properly. William Jacobson joins us right now. He is Cornell Law Professor, the mind behind LegalInsurrection.com, and one of your latest pieces, Cornell's Charlottesville Moment, Chance for Intifada, Reflect Anti-Israel Death Cult Ideology. This was your latest appearance on Fox News, and I do want to discuss what it is you've been experiencing. But first, let's get to this lawsuit. A class action lawsuit against Columbia, alleging that the university has failed to provide a safe environment for its students. Now, we know what has happened, and certainly we can discuss it, but this is an interesting conversation that I assume revolves around not only the university's own codes of ethics and performance, but around Title VI. Talk to me about what you know about this lawsuit, and can a class action lawsuit in this situation work?
Well, all I know about the lawsuit is what the lawsuit says, and the lawsuit asserts a single breach of contract claim. So it does not assert statutory civil rights claims. It says here are, and it quotes them and lists them, 8, 10, 12 promises that Columbia has made in writing to students. So I think it's probably a smart move that they did it that way. It's unlike other lawsuits that have been brought where there people are trying to, claim there's a civil rights violation. This is simply saying you made us a promise. You didn't live up to it. Now you've got to, and then it's the got to what they need to do. I think they're seeking for, tuition refunds because classes are disrupted. One of the promises was that, you would actually get the education that you've been promised. So that's what it is, a very interesting way of approaching it. Whether it survives or doesn't survive, perhaps we'll find out soon, but it's not a civil rights claim. It is a claim that you breached your contract with students by failing to provide an environment free from discrimination and harassment.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
Every day, we move in and out of each other's busy lives.
It's easy to take for granted all the little moments that make up our everyday.
Some are good,
others not so much.
But that's life.
It's when something doesn't seem quite right
that it's time to pay attention.
Because only you know what's not supposed to be in your everyday.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
Were you born from 1945 to 1965? People born during these years are 5 times more likely to have hepatitis C. But most people don't know they are infected. So even if you try to eat right, exercise, and take care of yourself, you can still have hepatitis C, a serious liver disease that often has no symptoms. In fact, people can live with hepatitis C for decades without feeling or looking sick. But over time, hepatitis C can cause serious health problems, including liver damage, liver failure, or even liver cancer. Getting tested is the only way to know if you're infected with hepatitis C. That's why the CDC recommends everyone born from 1945 to 1965 get a blood test for hepatitis C. Treatments are available that can cure this disease. So talk to your doctor about getting tested. It could save your life. A message from the CDC.
I asked what kind of family she wanted. She said, a family like yours.
Learn more about adopting a teen at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Indy Humane. Find your new best friend today. Visit IndyHumane.org.
Professor, LegalInsurrection.com, about the possibility of lawsuits against Columbia from students. And one of the questions was, as this class action suit is about the campus failing to protect students and there should be full refunds, William Jacobson, glad to bring you back here, is about the idea of, can the university say, hey, wait a second, we tried to do this, we tried to do that, but it was, the term I was using was force majeure, an act of God. We just had no way of stopping this from happening. Does the university, based on what you've read about the case, can they make the claim of, hey, we tried to get things done here, it just took a little bit of time?
Well, I think that would be one of their main defenses. It's a kind of a factual defense, not a legal defense, which is that, you know, we can only do what we can do, and we did everything we could do that's reasonable. So I think that will pretty much be their defense.
Now, this kind of lawsuit, you could argue that this could be happening at UCLA. This could be happening at USC. This could be happening at a host of universities. When a class action suit goes out like this, is this presented just in front of a judge? There's no jury in these kinds of cases. So who exactly do you have to convince here?
Well, first you're going to have to convince a judge because they're asking that this be certified as a class action. So you're going to have to get past that procedural hurdle. You're going to have to show you meet the qualifications for a class action. And then I forget if they demand a jury in this case, but sure, in a contract case, you can go to a jury. That's not an issue. They seem to be seeking injunctive relief also. That would come from the judge. So that might be an interim sort of order. So I think that eventually this could be before a jury when it comes to the monetary award, if there is one. Obviously, we're a long way from that, against the university.
Is it just in your view? Right, you have a really unique perch there at Cornell as somebody who is a professor, as somebody who gets faces the slings and arrows on campus for leaning politically right, for being Jewish, and Cornell has been a hotbed of madness. You have a piece up about Cornell's Charlottesville moment. You can find that at LegalInsurrection.com. Talking to William Jacobson, Cornell law professor. Chance for Intifada reflect anti-Israel death cult ideology. If that's the way Cornell students feel as well, do you think that these kinds of cases can find their way percolating across the Ivy Leagues and quote-unquote the better schools?
Well, at Cornell, there has not been an interruption of classes as there has been at Columbia. There has not been a general lockdown on the campus like there has been at Columbia. There has not been a switch to online learning, which is part of the claim here. We're paying for in-person, not online. So while some of the rhetoric is similar at Cornell as it is at Columbia, it has not had the impact on the campus and the learning experience. So I think it would be a much tougher claim to bring against Cornell based on breach of contract like it has been against Columbia. So I think it would be tougher. So it depends on the circumstances. Columbia is one of the worst because it's in New York City. Got a lot of outside activists coming onto campus, which is what I'm sure the administration will say. There's only so much we can do. And we've tried to weave our way to the best result, but there's all these outside forces imposing themselves on the campus. So I think that it doesn't necessarily apply across the board. There have been multiple other lawsuits based on alleged civil rights violations that you've deprived students of their statutory right to an a fair education on your campus because you receive federal funding. So each situation is different, but this one seems to be a different type of lawsuit than we've seen elsewhere.
Let's talk about what it is Governor Ron DeSantis said as I started. In Florida, the inmates will not run the asylum. University of Florida actually putting out a statement saying, let's be clear, this is not a daycare. Yet you have Northwestern University and Brown University reaching deals with student protesters. And even at the Chicago Tribune, the editorial reads, Northwestern did well removing tents without brute tactics. What kind of deal is Northwestern, what kind of deal have they put together agreeing with these students if these students are screaming boycott, divestment, sanction, and free Palestine and the genocidal slogan of from the river to the sea?
Well, I think Brown is even worse. So at Northwestern, they've agreed to create scholarships for Palestinian students to come to campus and a couple of faculty spots for Palestinian professors. So I think that's, you know, rewarding bad and in some instances criminal behavior. It's despicable what they've done. Brown's even worse. Brown University in Rhode Island, according to the agreement I saw posted online, has agreed that in exchange for abandoning their illegal encampment on campus, the Brown will put to a vote at the Board of Trustees in October a divestment resolution against Israel. Doesn't mean the board will vote for it, but the students got something big out of this. This is going to go to the board, and the agreement says that that vote will not be postponed beyond October. So it's outrageous. It's absolutely outrageous. We're paying ransom to these students for criminal or certainly violative of school conduct rule behavior. And it's just terrible. It repeats everything that I've said before. Academia is lost. It is hopeless. It cannot be reformed internally. You need a strong leader like Ron DeSantis in Florida is doing with his state system, because these administrators at the individual schools are, you know, love to pay ransom. They agree with these protesters in many instances. They cannot be reformed internally. Academia, as we know it, throughout much of the United States has been completely corrupted.
One of the things that you have talked about, you've been very, very vocal on the subject. You were recently on the Daily Signal podcast, which is part of Heritage, and you talk about university presidents specifically, and your quote is here, they have participated in the creation of a monstrous movement on campuses that is anti-American, anti-Western, anti-capitalist, and that urges, that uses targeting of Jews in Israel as an organizing mechanism. It is a tear down the statutes ideologies, the statutes ideology. It is remove names from buildings ideology. It is a deconstruction of our society. It is very reminiscent to me, this is you speaking, William Jacobson, of a Khmer Rouge in Cambodia sort of ideology where you go back to year zero. I talk about this being not about Israel and not about Jews, even though that's the first target. It is about us, and it is about how we live as Americans. Break this down a little bit further for us, if you would.
Sure. If you look at the ideology, if you listen to what they actually say at these encampments and they say in their groups and they say, you know, in their activist communications, they hate the United States deeply. OK, they hate our system. They hate our country. They hate everything about us. They want to tear us down. That's what they say. They also hate Israel and want to tear it down. But that, they don't hate us because of Israel. They hate us because we're capitalist. They hate us because of our history. They hate us because of, they think we're systemically and irredeemably racist. They think that we oppress people. They think that we're the major problem in the world. People need to understand that while they do hate Israel, many of them do hate Jews, And that's why they hate Israel. If Israel wasn't a majority Jewish country, they wouldn't care about Israel. But it's majority Jewish. That's what they hate about it. So, yes, they hate Israel. Yes, many of them hate Jews. But more than anything, they hate the United States and they hate capitalism. And they tell us that every single day, but nobody seems to want to listen to it.
Part of the issue there, talking to William Jacobson, Cornell Law Professor, LegalInsurrection.com, is that, and this has been my take anecdotally, people cannot square the circle. Why would they hate something that works? And how? And when you explain, well, the objective is to move about their ideology, which is a power ideology, not a money ideology, where they're in control and their quote-unquote value system is in control. And people say, oh, you again with the control thing. That's ridiculous. How do you describe that to people?
They want to tear us down. They want it's two threads here. You have the Khmer Rouge, let's tear it down. The only way we can construct a true Marxist-based society is by starting at year zero. So you have that end of the horseshoe. At the other end of the horseshoe, you have the Islamists, who are violent terrorists and who want to take us back to the 8th century. So the leftists want to take us back to year zero. The Islamists want to take us back to the 8th century. But both of those are dependent upon tearing us down, about destroying our system. And that's what people need to understand. You have two threads on campus, often referred to as the Red-Green Alliance, communist. I would throw anarchist in with that also. Communist/anarchist/extreme leftist on one end, and you have Islamists on the other. And they are united in one and only one thing, and that's destroying us. And then they will fight it out. And we know what happens when they fight it out. The Islamists always win. They won in Iran. That's what happened. Iranian revolution was the communists and the Islamists getting together to overthrow the Shah. Then the Islamists turned on the communists and slaughtered all the ones who couldn't escape. So, but that's what they have in mind. They both want to tear us down for different reasons.
William Jacobson, Cornell Law Professor, LegalInsurrection.com. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us. Safe work on campus. It is hard to fathom that what William Jacobson's talking about, what we talk about on a regular basis, is actually a goal, a desire, a want, for many a need, except it is. And part of the hard part of this is accepting that it is. And these events that we have seen for some people have been just like September 12th was a turning point for some people. They didn't know that we were in danger. They didn't know what Islamists were all about until September 11th. And then September 12th, they woke up and they said, oh. And for a lot of people, October 8th is exactly that. They really thought, they believed Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, we've had more peace in the Middle East than ever. There's never been a quieter time in the Middle East. And 2 weeks later, there's Hamas supported by Iran, a terrorist organization supporting a terrorist organization, murdering 1,200 people. And people woke up on October 8th and they said, oh. And now you have these protests. It was all about how Israel is treating Gaza and we shouldn't be supporting Israel, and how quickly it morphed into Israel shouldn't exist and all Zionists should die and capitalism is evil and we need a new socialist infrastructure. We need to impart a socialist ideology over all the country. And I don't know what day you want to give it. Maybe it was May 1st, which I think might be a little problematic for some people. And they went, oh. That's how sometimes these things happen, sadly. People don't know enough to protect themselves. They don't know enough to fight back. They refuse to believe that the bad thing happening to them is happening to them. They refuse to believe they are the frog in the water and the water is boiling. Well, I don't know how much more proof you need. The desire is for us to give up a way of life. I think our desire should be to say no to that. I'm Tony Katz. So the plan now from the White House, in addition to all their other plans, is to reclassify marijuana.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. A bag of weed, a bag of weed. Oh, everything is better with a bag of weed. It's the only help that you'll ever need, because everything is better with a bag of weed.
The plan is to say, why is this Schedule 1? We're going to make this Schedule 3. I think that's the schedule. I'm not an expert on schedules, nor am I an expert on marijuana. I'm not bragging. I'm just stating a fact. And then I realized that if I did this on a Monday, I was not properly functioning again until Thursday, and that didn't make any sense to me, so I stopped. The phone number is 833-GOT-TONY, 833-468-8669-833-GOT-TONY. They want to change the classification. And they want to classify it as a less dangerous drug. So it's been Schedule 1, according to the Wall Street Journal, since 1970. Right? There it is with LSD and heroin. I have no cheers to give heroin. But I've met some people who've done LSD, and they seem to have enjoyed it. I do not promote such things. Right? It's the idea that, like, somehow you think you're going to win the fight. That's the weirdest part, right? So I've done things. And by the way, things. I told you what I've done. That's it. I've never done anything else. I've never done any. What's weird is I could talk about marijuana, but I can't say I've ever done anything hard, which is weird because some people might consider marijuana hard. But in today's world, nobody considers it hard. Anything that I can smell while I'm walking through the streets of Chicago can't be considered hard. I've never done anything else. I've never gotten into it. I never found the place where I'm like, that would be fantastic. Just, I don't know, maybe all the scared straight stuff worked on me. I don't 100%, but I also feel that way about prescriptions. But I understand how like that happened. So I was, before I got my first radio gig in Indianapolis, I was trying to get on radio anywhere. I was buying time on stations. I was hustling, doing anything. And when the opportunity came for me, I heard about an opening at WIBC in Indianapolis, and I was doing a weekend show with one of their other stations in St. Louis, and I was living in Los Angeles. Don't ask. And I called and I said, I want to try out for this. And the program director, who is still the program director, the guy who hired me, brought me to Indianapolis eventually, said, well, you can come out and audition if you want. No one offered me a plane ticket. No one offered me a hotel. I was broke beyond broke. I mean, I had nothing. I lost it. I lost everything, right? What do you do when you settle on your house? It's not a foreclosure. There's a term for it. I did that. Lost the house. Lost it all. It was a bad, bad time. And the only thing I didn't do was go bankrupt. I paid off, worked out deals with all of the credit card stuff and paid them, and I just lost everything. But I flew myself out to Indianapolis, and I did this three-day tryout for afternoon drive, and they did not hire me. They hired, if you've ever heard of them, the Chicks on the Right. That's who they hired instead of me. They were local, and it killed me, but I understood it. Never had an issue with them before. They've now got the podcast and the website wildly popular. And the day I found out I didn't get the gig, I was in a doctor's office. I was in a doctor's office because I had torn my right bicep tendon, ripped it in half. My in-laws were in town, and we were in California at the time. And we were going to take the kids to, I think it was the propulsion lab there in Pasadena. Very, very cool. Some museum. And we had a third row of seats. So I was going to open up the third row of seats in a Honda Pilot. And you lift up the latch and then you pull it open. Well, I didn't lift up the latch enough. My right hand on the latch, and I went to pull it. Snap, 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 snap. I heard it. I screamed because you don't know what that is, right? And I literally dropped to a knee and I'm calling my wife's name. It took me a second because it was the shock of it first. You knew something was up. It felt weird. But I'm like, you have to take me to a hospital right now. I wasn't in pain. And that's weird. It wasn't in pain. And it was like, all right, let's head to our doctor. We won't go to the hospital. Head to the doctor. And the doctor's like, oh, yeah, you did this. You need a surgery. The doctor performs the surgery. And for the record, it did not go great. I come home from the surgery, which is really a short kind of procedure. I am in this device, a contraption, right? Keeping your elbow bent. And as I'm laying in bed, it was the night I got back, and I went to go adjust. I felt a twinge in my elbow. And I looked at my elbow and out loud said, what is that? 10 minutes later, I was in an ambulance. In my life, I have never felt such pain. It was excruciating and unbearable. Unbearable. And went to the hospital, a nerve or whatever else. They admit me. I end up taking an Ambien. Ladies and gentlemen, I do not know if you have ever taken an Ambien, but allow me to be the guy who says to you as a public service announcement, I'm Tony Katz, never, ever, ever, ever take an Ambien. You will regret it. My experience with Ambien involves the following scenario. Me in not a room, but not the ER, a holding room of sorts, staring at the clock on the wall, one of those clocks you would see in middle school. And the second hand kept ticking and never moved. Now, I knew that was not possible. The second hand should be moving. But the second hand was not moving. That second hand didn't move at all. Just kept flicking to the same spot. And I said, this is terrible. When I got home, there were a serious amount of painkillers that I really had never even gotten a chance to try. Because it's a surgery. And the anesthesia is going to wear off. It's going to be painful. And I was already in massive pain. And I took whatever the pain pill they described was. And I was sitting at, and I was in pain. I was sitting at my kitchen table. My wife was across from me. And I had taken the pill, and I don't know the amount of minutes it was in between. This was hours and hours after the Ambien had worn off, right? This is all in the course of a couple days. I felt it tingle in my toes. And actually said, oh, this is happening. And I felt it come over me. And then I felt nothing. You could have hit me with a baseball bat in the skull while hitting me with another baseball bat in the skull. I would have felt nothing. This was a very different experience from the Ambien, which, by the way, I'm Tony Katz telling you, never take Ambien. By the way, I'm not a doctor. You do what your doctor tells you. And I said to my wife, oh, this is why people do drugs. In my life, I mean, I have had operations and things before, but that was in a hospital setting, never really taking any pain medication when I got home of this type. The minute that happened, I said, this is why people do it. This is why people do drugs. This is why this is the feeling, clearly, that people are looking for that they can't figure out how to do on their own. oh my gosh, I totally understand how people who deal with chronic issues or a sports injury or it's remarkable how easy it must be, because if you numb yourself to the pain enough, when the pain comes back, it must be something else. A near impossible thing to overcome. When they tell me they want to reclassify marijuana as less dangerous, it is not that I have an issue with the legalization of marijuana. Certainly on a medicinal side, and I'm not even so sure I'm bothered specifically about a recreational side, even though I don't want to smell it walking down the street. I don't know where they think they can utilize the terminology less dangerous. If marijuana is still marijuana, then it is not less dangerous because of some level of classification. And if the White House is stating it as such, they're trying to say that somehow, well, we've taken a look at marijuana, and it turns out, nah, none of the issues matter. The issues could still absolutely be there. And there, while there are people who absolutely favor its legalization, and we'll talk about reductions in pain and things like that, there'll be others who tell you, of course it creates this issue, and of course it creates that issue, and here's the study here, and here's the study there. I can say the same thing about alcohol in many, many ways. I'm a guy who supports the spirits industry. Literally have a show called Eat, Drink, Smoke, where I review bourbon every week. I wrote a book about bourbon. It's not War and Peace, but it's a nice little reader. It's like I wrote a book about barbecue. It is not the end-all, be-all of barbecue. I just happen to like what we put in there. Maybe help some people learn a little something about barbecue. Then they'll go read something else that's, you know, more official. Knock yourself out. Only hope you enjoy it. But I'm a guy who sips. I can sip a bourbon. I can nurse a bourbon like it's my job. The amount of bourbons I finish is near zero. It doesn't change the issue of drinking an alcoholic beverage. I'm not opposed to it. I'm not trying to be puritanical about the thing. I am saying that the idea that it is somehow less dangerous because the government engages a reclassification is a nutty thought. So the Justice Department says the proposed rule, which has not been made public, would downgrade marijuana to a Schedule 3, making it obtainable with a prescription. Well, that leads to, of course, meaning that it's going to be legalized. If you can prescribe it, now somebody has to provide it. This is where I have always said that, for example, my state, Indiana, doesn't have legalized marijuana. And the argument's always been because it's not legalized federally. Well, if you now offer it up via prescription, you can now have the conversation of legalizing it in the state. And my argument has always been I'm absolutely, absolutely going to get a license. I'm going to open a dispensary, absolutely. Now, maybe I don't open a dispensary, but I'm absolutely going to get a license because my fear is that there are going to be those people who say, well, we really need to control this. So therefore, only this group of people, the people who already own liquor stores, let's say, or the people who are already in this industry, they should be the only people who can get a license. Oh, no. No, I am willing to spend every dollar suing everyone I can to ensure that the people, if they want to get into the industry, should be able to get into the industry. We aren't keeping people out of the industry. That's nuts. And we saw things like this happen in Ohio, and the people of Iowa said, no thanks, we're not going to give this to just a small cabal of people to have total domination over. But it isn't less dangerous. Does that make sense? That's a weird way to describe it. Check with your doctor. Decide for yourself. Do what you're going to do. But let me say one more time. Seriously, the Ambien? I mean, listen to your doctor, not me, but yeah, I ain't going back. I'm Tony Katz.
The anti-Semitism bill that Mike Lawler has a definition that is so broad that many of the Jewish groups like J Street and Nexus and others cannot support. So why would you do that except if you want to weaponize anti-Semitism and you want to use it as a political ploy?
Now, I will say that there's this push on Congress to try and create a piece of legislation regarding anti-Semitism. I want to look at it, but that was Representative Pramila Jayapal, communist, Washington State. Oh, she heads up the Progressive Caucus. I feel pretty good about it. Don't ever say J Street is a Jewish group. Because they say they are. Because they say, look at us, we're Jewish. You're right, I don't get to tell them they're not Jewish. But I look at their policies, and there won't be many Jews for long if they got their way. I'm Tony Katz.
I asked what kind of family she wanted. She said, a family like yours.
Learn more about adopting a teen at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Indie Humane. Find your new best friend today. Visit IndieHumane.org.